This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Historian Douglas Brinkley watched history being made as his city was destroyed. He lives in New Orleans, where he directs the Roosevelt Center at Tulane University. He was in the city for Hurricane Katrina and took part in boat rescue efforts. Then he created a Tulane University task force to document the catastrophe through oral history. Now he's written a new book called The Great Deluge, documenting the week the hurricane struck. Brinkley is the author of several best-selling books, including Tour of Duty, John Kerry in the Vietnam War, and The Boys of Pointe du Hoc, Ronald Reagan, D-Day, and the U.S. Army 2nd Ranger Battalion. About his new book, he writes, he hopes that this history, fast out of the gates, may serve as an opening effort in Katrina scholarship. Your book was excerpted in Vanity Fair, and what's really made news from that excerpt is your reporting on Mayor Ray Nagin. And you write, to some observers, the naive politician was turning into a pathetic figure, the city's skipper who didn't know what a boom was. How would you describe Mayor Nagin's performance based on the interviews and reporting you've done for your book?
I interviewed Mayor Nagin for the book. I've also interviewed people that were holed up with him at the Hyatt Hotel. What's making a little bit of news, what was in the Vanity Fair excerpt, and what's making Mayor Nagin very uncomfortable, to put it mildly, is the reality that when the storm hit, he was supposed to be at the Emergency Operations Center at City Hall. The New Orleans City Hall is across the street from the Superdome and the Hyatt, and it is a sturdy building. It's almost it's one of the sturdiest buildings in New Orleans, and an EOC was set up there, Emergency Operations Center. He didn't go there. He instead, and he told me the reason why, is he had security guards that wanted him to stay at the Hyatt. Yet Terry Ebert of Homeland Security, one of the great heroes of my book, he stayed and ran the city while the mayor went to the Hyatt, checked in to the 27th floor, and that entire week that I write about, when we watched on television all these people at the Superdome trying to figure out what's happening, all these people at the convention center, he never once had the courage to leave his bunker and to go over and address the people, to talk to them, to inspire them, to lead. So I'm questioning the book, the leadership, you know. And because I love my city so much, I felt I had to tell everything that I knew, not hold back on my critique and criticism, which is something historians usually don't do. But, you know, I'm a person who witnessed people being treated like garbage and debris, and the mayor was partially responsible for that pathetic response we had to helping those people in need.
Do you think that the mayor was rightfully concerned about his security and that prevented him from being more visible? I mean, for example, there's one part in the book where an aide tells him that a mob from the Superdome is approaching the hotel where the mayor is staying, and the aide urges the mayor to go up to a higher floor.
Well, the higher floor is the 27th floor of the Hyatt. That's the top of the building, and that's where he spent most of the week. And the anecdote you're mentioning is about Jackie Clarkson, whose daughter, incidentally, is the actress Patricia Clarkson, who's been a longtime city councilwoman. And she was working the phone. She was at the EOC at City Hall for a long time. Everybody at the City Hall I talked to wondered where the mayor was. They felt abandoned at City Hall by the mayor because he had his hideout strategy. And she tells the story, they're on the fourth floor, somebody whispers a mob's coming, and he immediately leaps up and runs up to the 27th floor. There was no mob. These were people at the Superdome looking for food and water.
You sound a little angry when you describe what Mayor Nagin did and didn't do during the week of the hurricane. Now, I know you're a New Orleans resident and you care deeply about the city, but I'm wondering if that kind of anger and passion ever got in the way at all with your work as a historian trying to write this first history of the hurricane.
It certainly got in the way. I'm a human, and I watched other humans, people of authority that we count on in time of crisis, turn their back on the poor, largely African-American population of my city. And, you know, I did not, you know, I have tools I use as a historian, but I will not deny that there's a passion in my book. that there's an anger at government officials. I'm angry at the Army Corps of Engineers for building shoddy levees. I'm angry that the sense of coastal restoration cannot be made a national issue. We're losing our wetlands, that every day the Gulf of Mexico is getting closer to New Orleans. I'm angry that gas revenues from oil from the state of Louisiana are always taken. We are a state where we're abused by companies. We're a place where people extract but don't put money back in. That New Orleans has been losing population. Garbage is everywhere right now. We're heading into a hurricane season without a sensible evacuation plan. All of our buses that should have been put on high ground, when you have a Category 3 or 4 or 5 brewing in the Gulf, were left to drown in the city of New Orleans. And it's just common sense. The Louisiana National Guard left their assets below sea level at Jackson Barracks. I mean, it's one debacle after another after another.
Is it worse than you thought? I mean, you were obviously upset before you started this book. But having done all the research and written this up, are you even angrier than you were before? Or more upset?
Absolutely.
More discouraged?
Both. And on the one hand, I'm uplifted by the human stories I've encountered. When I write about the so-called NOLA homeboys, New Orleans homeboys, this group of people that jumped in the water and were saving everybody on little boats. And I've interviewed, 100 of these first responders. Dr. Ruth Bergson, I write about, who stayed at charity and wouldn't leave without her AIDS patients and the bond that they formed. I've been uplifted by the human response, what real people did, how Louisianans saved Louisianans, how Mississippians saved Mississippians. So that part has been heartening, and it gives me a kind of faith in our country, a renewed faith in an unbelievable way on our people. But the government attitude towards it has infuriated me. I praise the holy heaven in this book, the private sector, companies that did great. But you would have Walmart trucks coming to try to quickly bring in supplies and be stopped by FEMA officials with clipboards who said they're not on their computer punch out. They're not allowed to bring in supplies. You have the Gretna Bridge incident where largely African-Americans from the convention center, dehydrated, without water, without food, was trying to walk over the Mississippi River, a great symbol of our country, the Mississippi, walk over the Mississippi River Bridge, and were met by the Gretna police force with guns pointed at them, turned back, not allowing them to escape the deprivations of the city.
You really are very critical of the government response to Katrina, but somebody who you single out for praise is Terry Ebert of Homeland Security. In what sense do you think he did well?
Well, Terry Ebert is a lieutenant, ex-lieutenant colonel, a Marine with service in Vietnam. He was in a lot of combat. He had a lot of his lung shot out. He, for a while, was ahead of our Pacific Theater nuclear security. So he's a very important person, and he was assigned to New Orleans for Homeland Security. When Katrina started, he never left his post at the Emergency Operations Center. And while everything was crumbling from a leadership standpoint around him, I think the fact that he had been through combat in Vietnam helped him. At least that was, he told me it did. And I believe that because he stayed cool and collected. He essentially ran the city the best that he could without a police force that was there to help in any real sense. But he was able to use the fire department people that he could get to effectively. And he became the vortex.
We're nearing hurricane season. Are you confident living in New Orleans with the city in such a fragile state? Do you have any faith in the levees or in the evacuation plan?
No, I have no faith in the evacuation plan as it now is. It's been very slow out of the gate. They're trying to get one forward. Hurricane season's upon us. This happens time and again in New Orleans. It's New Orleans is the best city in America for food, in my opinion. Food and music and cultural life and ambience. It's my favorite city in America. We don't do politics well. We don't know how to do it. And, you know, it was bad before Katrina. Now everything is kind of in disarray. My wife is pregnant, and we're going to hopefully, God willing, have a baby girl this summer. And I would never think of having it in a hospital in New Orleans right now. We're going out to where my mother and father live in California to have the child. My other two children were born at Touro Hospital in New Orleans. I would have liked all three of them to be. I don't trust the hospitals there. And I have to tell you, the electrical grid in the city's a strong wind's going to black out the city. Not a hurricane, not even a tropical storm, just a really bad storm, and the city's going to be in danger. The sewer system is cracking. It's leaking over places. People with getting allergies and illnesses from mold in their houses. We're still in crisis mode in New Orleans. The dilemma, the paradox, is when I say things like that, I also am supposed to be a city booster. Come back to New Orleans. Come party down there. We need the tourist revenue. And so it's a city conflicted, and until we get our politics right, it's going to be hard to convince people in conventions. Philadelphia, where you at? Are a company in Philly, are they going to want to come? They're booking their conventions 2 years out now. Are they really going to come to New Orleans when they have other options? So we got to get a new message out of our city that we're really taking our politics seriously and our public policy seriously. We have a reputation nationally for not doing that. And unfortunately, since Katrina, things that same sliding into failure are occurring.
My guest is historian Douglas Brinkley. His new book is called The Great Deluge. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Douglas Brinkley. He's a historian who has written a new book about Katrina. It's called The Great Deluge. He lives in New Orleans and teaches at Tulane University. You describe New Orleans politics as historically dysfunctional. Do you feel like you have any sense of why that's true?
It's a port city, and a lot of the world's port cities tend to be politically dysfunctional because money comes and goes through import and exports, and it's easy to turn a blind eye to thing, and cultures of corruption can get started. That's certainly the case there. It used to be, you know, people talk about Jean Lafitte, the pirate. I mean, he was a slave stealer. He wasn't just trading in slaves. He'd rob slave ships and then sell them for cheaper prices. And yet he's kind of a cultural hero in town. Governor Edwards of Louisiana is kind of beloved. He might be able to win the governorship if he ran again, yet he's in prison right now for corruption. A police department is wildly corrupt to the point that I don't think people in the rest of the country understand how corrupt it's payoffs and turning your back and allowing drug dealers to run rampant and it's all with the kind of laissez-faire attitude, you know, let the good times roll. We're about celebrating our culture, which is the genius and beauty. It's the great, one of the great literary and art capitals in the home of jazz. And I mean, we all know all of that, but when it comes to politics, people laugh about it. It's no longer funny to tell the story about the politician with cash in a brown paper bag. Katrina doesn't make those stories, kind of quirky and interesting. It makes it reprehensible because you see that bad politics and corrupt politics causes great damage to people's lives and even costs them their lives. So the people in the community that care have to rally against the wrong kind of politics, and we're doing that. There is a wonderful man who's the district attorney of New Orleans named Eddie Jordan, and he's a great leader. And you know, there are people coming up that are going to make a difference, the Warren Rileys and Eddie Jordans. And so there's hope on the way. It's just, it's hard to weed it out and change. The FBI has embedded really with the New Orleans Police Department, and they're doing an extraordinary job, the FBI, of trying to train the police department to get away from that culture of corruption and turn more towards public integrity.
Before you decided to write this history of this first week of Hurricane Katrina and its aftermath, you were writing a book on Teddy Roosevelt and conservation. And I'm wondering if there's any intersection between those two books.
Only to the extent that I quote in this book about, you know, 100 years ago, Theodore Roosevelt, our great conservationist, went down to the Brenton Island. There's a whole group, if listeners look on a map and they don't know the region, you'll see these beautiful islands that are in the Gulf of Mexico. And TR went down 100 years ago to try to save the bird rookeries there. And he warned people that hurricanes coming up, if these islands aren't kept as barrier islands, New Orleans would get devastated by a hurricane. That barrier islands weren't just, you know, for birds, they were important as a speed bump for hurricanes in the Gulf of Mexico. He was an extraordinarily sophisticated naturalist, TR. His thinking is 100 years ago is relevant today. Unfortunately, these islands are disappearing. The coastal erosion, the barrier islands are shrunken. Louisiana is just losing its incredible wetlands every day. And so in that regard, one of the big issues in the early part of my book is how the Gulf South wasn't prepared for this hurricane. And by not taking these barrier islands seriously and having the federal government not take them seriously enough, by being seen as a green issue instead of a security issue, as well as a green issue, we're losing Louisiana. These barrier islands need to be rebuilt. They are the first bump, as I said, speed bump to stop these hurricanes before they make landfall.
You say in your book that it was books and music that sustained you while you were writing your new book, The Great Deluge. What did you read and listen to?
A lot of Bob Dylan, the Martin Scorsese, No Direction Home CD, which went with the PBS documentary. It came out right at the time of Katrina, and songs like when the ship comes in, with lines about hurricanes, and Chimes of Freedom by Bob Dylan, I would play over and over again on my iPod. The Neville Brothers. I was listening to Willie Nelson, who sings a song by Daniel Lanois called "The Maker." And if everybody listening to this, I just urge him to listen to the beauty of this song, "The Maker," which is very fitting for what happened in Katrina, and the Willie Nelson's version of singing in it is beautiful. And book-wise, I turned immediately when this happened to John Steinbeck, and I reread Grapes of Wrath because I thought the exodus from New Orleans, I don't have the skills, I'm not a good enough writer to ever try to do what Steinbeck did, and I'm with the Okies and the Dust Bowl. But I saw how he gave dignity to the Joad family, and I then went back and looked at Cannery Row and some of Steinbeck's works when I was writing this, and he kind of set a tone for me. There's a Nobel Prize-winning writer from Iceland. His name's Halldór Laxness, and he wrote a book called Under the Glacier, and it's about bureaucratic ineptitude in part. And he does it so brilliantly. And that novel, Under the Glacier, by, our, as I said, a Nobel Prize-winning Iceland author from Iceland, had a profound effect on me. I hadn't read it, and when I read it, it made me realize that this happens in life, that this sort of political indifference to the plight of the poor and politicians worrying about their image more than truly helping people is not unique to Katrina, that it has many antecedents in past history.
Well, Doug Brinkley, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Doug Brinkley's new book is called The Great Deluge. You can find an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org.